Now, the U.S. Supreme Court announced they would not hear Wisconsin's John Doe appeal. That decision came down earlier today.
The case is centered on an investigation into the use of corporate money in the election campaigns of Governor Scott Walker and other Republicans in the state, particularly during recall elections.
Howard Schwaber is with us now for the details on why the Supreme Court declined the appeal. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So were you surprised that the Supreme Court didn't take this up?
Slightly. I'm not surprised, but only because of the unique and peculiar circumstances in which the court now finds itself. If there were 9 members, I think it's far more likely they would have taken the case.
Really? Why 8 members deciding that they wouldn't take this one? Are they just taking fewer cases, period?
No, they've taken a number of cases already for this coming term, and they will certainly take more. The Supreme Court historically goes to great lengths to avoid a tie outcome. So, for example, even when there have been 9 members on the court, where one member has recused him or herself, such that there were 8 members left, the court has usually not taken the case. If there was a serious likelihood of a 4-4 outcome, and that's quite sensible, since no one really knows what a tie outcome would mean. We don't have anything in our system. That's why we have an odd number of Supreme Court justices. We don't have anything in our system to explain exactly what happens in the case of a tie vote, other than that the lower court's ruling stands undisturbed, but it has been cast very much in doubt. So it seems plausible that, looking ahead, people within the court concluded this was likely to result in a 4-4 tie and therefore chose not to take the case.
Interesting. But one thing we don't know for sure is why they didn't take it up. As I understand it, the Supreme Court doesn't issue an explanation when they don't take something up.
That's correct. This is entirely my speculation. My apologies. I should have been clear about
that. That's okay. I've heard this about other cases, the idea that they want to avoid ties.
Most famous is the Pledge of Allegiance case, the Newdow case, which was confronted a similar situation. There are instances in which when the Supreme Court declines to take a case, one of the justices who disapproves of that decision will write a dissent from the denial. That has been known to happen, although it didn't happen in this case.
Well, now let's back things up a bit and look at the progress of this John Doe investigation. Technically, this is actually John Doe 2, the second one, which arose out of the first one. What do you see as the core issues, the core legal issues at stake in this investigation?
Well, it's a long and complicated story. By the time we get to the U.S. Supreme Court stage of things, there's really 2 separate questions. First, was the prosecution proper? You know, and what is the strength of the underlying claim that Walker and or his associates engaged in unlawful activities? Based on the public record, which is, of course, you know, the only thing to which I have access, that whatever has been in the press, based on that record, it seems extremely clear that there were criminal activities, and it's not surprising given that the first John Doe investigation resulted in several criminal convictions. The documents released to The Guardian recently merely confirmed what most of us already believed to be true, which was that there was overt evasion of rules against coordination. To put it in the simplest terms, there's a rule that says, for example, you can't make anonymous large donations to a candidate, but you can make those donations to a club. So let's say there was a candidate who is famously in favor of sports, and there was a club called the Club for Sports. It's perfectly okay to make large, anonymous, you know, secret donations to the Club for Sports as long as the Club for Sports isn't coordinating with the candidate, because that would be an end around, right? That would be an evasion of the rule against making that same kind of illegal donation to the candidate, which would be illegal. In this case, the candidate's chief advisor was also running the club, and the connections are multiple, and there's simply no question, even before this recent document dump, but certainly afterwards, that there was overt and explicit coordination between the campaign and the club, or the hypothetical club. So in terms of the underlying investigation, again, I'm speaking only based on the information available in the press, but that is, based on information, it looks as though there was a very strong case, and indeed both Republican and Democratic district attorneys approved the investigation in the first place. But that's really the less important part. The more important part is what happened to this investigation once it reached the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And there the problem was that members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court had received the same kind of donations from the same people who were being investigated in this investigation. And the justices made new rules to allow themselves to preside over the case, and then those same justices who would have been vulnerable to the same kind of charges chose to dismiss these. Now, at that point, we reach a level of corruption so deep that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in a previous case that it could violate due process.
But I want to jump in, Howard, and say, so these outside groups, the Club for Sports, or actually the Club for Growth, they're issue groups. They ultimately, when they run an ad, can't say vote for Howard Schwaber. They can't say vote for or against Scott Walker or Tom Barrett or any other candidate. That is an important legal distinction, isn't it?
Well, yes, but this isn't even about that. So, yes, there are rules. So in terms of what these clubs can do, so the Clubs for Growth, the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, there are very specific rules about how they may word or how they must word purchased advertisements. But actually, the case we're talking about involves much more than that. It involves direct collusion, securing of contributions, legislation that was enacted with at least the appearance of a quid pro quo in return for the organization of support, the same people running the fundraising efforts for the club who were running the Club for Growth, who were running the operations for Governor Walker and so on. So it goes way beyond the kind of wording restrictions we're used to hearing about in advertising cases.
We're talking to Howard Schwaber now about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision not to hear the Wisconsin John Doe appeal, centered on the investigation of the role of corporate money and outside groups in the election campaigns of Governor Scott Walker and other Republicans in the state.
And we're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this news? Do you think the U.S. Supreme Court should have heard the appeal to the state's John Doe case, or do you think it's time to leave that issue behind us? What would you like to see change, if anything, about campaign finance law in the United States? You can call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now about the news that the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear Wisconsin's John Doe appeal.
We're taking your calls now, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the John Doe investigation and its aftermath? Do you think the U.S. Supreme Court should have taken this case? Why or why not? And what would you like to see change about campaign finance laws? You can call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Howard Schwaber stays with us, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. We'll go to your calls now. Kenneth is on the line in Madison. Kenneth, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think this is a travesty, really. I mean, the guy's obviously broke the law, and because now we don't have an odd number of justices, it's not going to be heard. I was wondering if there's a chance it might be taken up when another justice is added to the court, or is it just simply dead and gone?
Kenneth, thanks for that call. Yeah, Howard, is there any precedent, I guess, for the Supreme Court denying a case, getting another justice, I guess, and picking it back up, or could it be re-brought or reappealed to the Supreme Court?
It cannot be reappealed directly. There are various ways in which historically in this situation cases have been reheard. But we need to be clear about what it is that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, that is, declined to hear. Since the Wisconsin Supreme Court made its ruling, there have been a bunch of changes to Wisconsin law to legalize what was previously illegal and to permit the state Supreme Court justices to rule on cases in which under the old ethics rules they wouldn't have been allowed to rule. So the question for the U.S. Supreme Court is basically whether the actions of the Wisconsin Supreme Court were so far beyond the realm of what looks like clean judging that it actually violated the Constitution. That's a big claim. The one time that claim has been upheld in a strong way, it came out of Kentucky a few years ago in a coal-related case. It's depressing, I think, that Wisconsin's judiciary is now being compared to those of places like Kentucky and Louisiana, but that's where we are. I think it's unlikely that the Supreme Court, even with a ninth justice, regardless of who that ninth justice is, will take up the case in the future.
Kenneth, thanks for the call. We'll go next to John on the line in Baraboo. John, hi.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. It really saddens me to see the Supreme Court continually influenced by big business and big interests, specifically David and Alan Koch. They were instrumental in writing, you know, Citizens United. In fact, I think they supplied the entirety of the amicus briefs for Citizens United. And now, not only in Wisconsin, they have their They have their money in nearly every Tea Party or Republican state, which the Republicans should be ashamed because the Tea Party basically co-opted the Republican Party.
John, thanks for the call. Howard, in this particular case, I don't know if there's overlap with Citizens United, but as part of a bigger trend, I mean, are we in the midst of a trend to allow, for better or worse, more money and more non-disclosed money into politics?
Absolutely. As Professor Richard Hazen put it recently, this is a great time to be a corrupt politician. There has never, in the last 50 years, there hasn't been a time when both the legislatures and the courts have worked so hard to make it so easy for politicians to receive money with nobody knowing about it, who's getting it or where it's coming from. You know, and the fact that we have a presidential candidate who's not only declining to reveal his taxes, but declining to reveal his donors is emblematic of that attitude. The Wisconsin case is not particularly about the same thing as Citizens United, and I do think the caller is overstating the role of the Koch brothers, but that's a whole different range of issues. But I think the caller is right in the sense that from the U.S. Supreme Court on down, we have been living through an era in the last decade or so, let's say, in which the courts in particular are very unwilling to say that the public desire to have trustworthy elections, you know, and transparency in the process of funding elections, that that's a legitimate desire that can be carried out by law. And instead, the idea has been to empower speakers, including corporate speakers and anonymous speakers and secret speakers, by way of spending money at the expense of any notion of public integrity.
Let's talk about the idea of corruption, Howard. I mean, some people draw the line and say, okay, if you hand me, candidate Rob Ferret, a bag of money or build me a swimming pool, stuff for my personal enrichment, that's corruption. Spending money on behalf of electing me to office is your right of political expression.
Absolutely. And the usual sharp line that one draws is what's called quid pro quo corruption. Hand me money and I will do action X. And of course, you know, if that happens, it's a crime and everyone agrees. Historically, we've allowed governments, legislatures to pass laws to restrict campaign funding to prevent the appearance of that kind of corruption, in the belief that maintaining public trust was important, and also to prevent indirect versions of that kind of corruption. So let me take a hypothetical example, which may be involved in some case that we're talking about, but go back to my Club for Sports hypothetical that I made up. Let's imagine that the people giving the money to the Club for Sports have wanted for a very long time a particular law. Let's say they give a lot of money to this club, which they know and the club knows will go directly to the candidate from the club, and the candidate turns around and promotes precisely the law these people have wanted all along. That looks a lot like quid pro quo corruption, which the money has merely been laundered through a third party's hands. Something very much like that happened with respect to liability for lead paint and donations to indirect donations to Governor Walker and Republican candidates from the lead paint industry, that those politicians then turned around and passed precisely the law that the lead paint industry had been looking to see enacted for a number of years. There is no evidence, there's no direct evidence that someone handed someone money and said, pass this law. There's just a remarkably direct circumstantial trail and very strong evidence of precisely the kind of coordination that's unlawful. And I think that's exactly why coordination is unlawful.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Howard Schwaber for joining us, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, looking about the U.S. Supreme Court's announcement today. They declined to hear an appeal in Wisconsin's ongoing John Doe court cases.